There are countless jobs that make a society function. What does it mean to perform a certain occupation? What are the day-to-day activities? This is Community Connections, and I'm your host, Heather Rose, and together, we aim to find out. Hi, this is Heather Rose of Community Connections, a program that chronicles the functions and everyday activities and the myriad roles we find in society. Joining us today is Dr. Mindy Kornhaber, Associate Professor Emerita at Penn State University. Hi, Mindy.
Hello, Heather.
Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. Well, first off, can our listeners get a little background about yourself?
Sure. Let's see. I have an undergrad degree in music, which is kind of surprising because my professional career has been in the area of education policy and testing and assessment. But it was a kind of twisty road. I was supposed to go to grad school in music history, but at the last minute I said, what do I do with this in the real world? Not too many people are interested in 16th century motets anymore. So I got myself a job in higher education, and eventually further up administrator said, you know, you really need a grad degree. Go to Harvard Grad School of Education, which was kind of a shocker to me. So I applied. I was admitted. I met Howard Gardner. I studied cognitive development and also education policy. So my focal question is, how do institutions and the policies surrounding them enhance or impede individual development? I worked at Project Zero, which was run by Howard Gardner and David Perkins for many years, for about 10 years on and off with grad school and being a mom. And then I worked for something called the Civil Rights Project, which was then headed by Gary Orfield and has since moved out to UCLA. And then I got called by Penn State and said, how'd you like to work here? I said, oh, that sounds okay.
Well, what's the Civil Rights Project?
The Civil Rights Project was founded in 96, I'm pretty sure, 1996. In response to the passage of Proposition 209 out in California, which limited that state's use of race in admissions to the state universities. So you can see that we've been around this block on and off for many, many, many years. And it's still in operation. They're looking at, they kind of have a network or nodes of people working in different parts of the country together with them. Gary Orfield, the former head, and Chris Edley, former head, have retired from the project and I think are just generally retired. Chris is in his 80s. No, Gary's in his 80s. Chris is in his later 70s, I'm guessing. So now a bunch of other people are obviously still engaged with that kind of work. How do we have schools and policies where all kids are treated to a good education and opportunities for learning continue?
So what's your opinion on that, especially in light of the recent Supreme Court decision?
Well, having been around these issues for many, many years, it is not and having looked at the changes in the court over, I would say, the Trump years, it's not at all a surprise that the court has decided this way. I think universities and colleges have had many years to consider different approaches. I myself wrote some things about this years ago. So I think, though it is a misguided decision, it is not going to entirely halt opportunities for African Americans in particular and other minority groups to have the chance to go to highly selective universities. It will likely have bigger effects in some places than in others. But for example, Texas has been using what they call the top 10% plan. It's not actually the top 10%, but they automatically, if you're a student in a Texas high school and graduate in the top 10% of your class, you're automatically admitted to UT. It's more the percentage is lower than that now. I think it's around 6-7%. But the problem with that is it relies on our high schools and school districts being segregated in order to have diversity. So Gary Orfield has written and spoken about that. It's a fix built on top of a broken foundation. But as a result, the University of Texas is fairly diverse. And I don't think you can assail that kind of admissions process because it just says everybody in the top X percent can be admitted. That will be to state universities. Private institutions will have different ways of handling the political impacts. So I can't say I'm surprised. I can't say it's misguided. I don't think we are in a post-racial society. The way to stop dealing with race is not to stop dealing with race, to paraphrase Justice Roberts, but this is where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, can you describe the theory of multiple intelligences to our listeners?
Sure. The theory of multiple intelligences was developed by Howard Gardner, drawing on a range of different kinds of data, including test scores, including anthropological sorts of studies, including what he calls symbol systems, which is what kinds of information have people decided to put into symbolic forms like mathematics or maps or language, written material. So there are 7 or 8 different bases on which he developed the theory. And the theory states pretty simply that all human beings have a range of capacities that innate relatively autonomous abilities or capacities that enable all people across cultures to develop solutions to problems or create products that are valued. So everybody, unless you're seriously debilitated, has all of the intelligences. Howard's put forth 8 different ones at this point. I could name them if it's helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are the traditional ones that we are usually tested for: language, which and logical mathematical intelligence, in addition to spatial intelligence, which is commonly found on standardized tests of intelligence. And then there is musical, bodily kinesthetic, interpersonal, intrapersonal, naturalist. And what am I missing? I think I'm missing.
What's
logical, mathematical, spatial, bodily kinesthetic, naturalist, intrapersonal, musical, right?
Right. But what's naturalist?
Okay, so the naturalist was the last one that Howard developed, and it happened after a conversation with E.O. Wilson, the ant man. He wrote sociobiology and was a scholar at Harvard whose focus was on ants. So what the naturalist intelligence says is that individuals have the capacity, all individuals have the capacity to draw on information from the natural world to solve problems or fashion products. So examples, I love this one because I'm into cooking. A chef understands how herbs, spices, various ingredients that you would gather in the natural world can be put into a beautiful new recipe, right? Mm-hmm. Or, more to the foundations of human civilization. If you wanted to survive as a person in the Stone Age, you better know what kind of rocks can be turned into arrowheads, right? Mm-hmm. So understanding the lay of the land, the materials of the world.
Okay. Well, what's about artistic?
So we have to distinguish between intelligences and domains, or what we would ordinarily call disciplines. So an arts discipline might be music or painting or dance. Each of those would draw on different intelligences. So an artistic, and Howard argues that all disciplines draw on several different, combine several different intelligences. So if you're a dancer, you're obviously engaged in bodily kinesthetic intelligence, musical intelligence, to some degree, interpersonal intelligence, right? Because you want to communicate with the audience. You're not dancing for yourself. And if you're dealing in musical intelligence, if you're a performer in music, you're dealing with musical intelligence, but also, I'm a flutist, bodily kinesthetic intelligence, right? How do you adjust your fingers? How do you adjust your mouth? And also interpersonal intelligence, right? You've got to watch the conductor, understand what the conductor is signaling to you. If you're in an orchestra, if you're a solo performer, you're dealing with interpersonal intelligence, right? So there are combinations of different intelligences that will go into any artistic activity.
Okay. Well, how is this theory applied to everyday life?
Well, I think the cooking example is a good one, right? In everyday life, we're drawing on a range of different intelligences to solve problems or create products. Another example would be, I go out and my car isn't working and I have a meeting in a half an hour. What do I, on the other side of town, what do I do? Well, I could call a friend to give me a ride. If I'm logical, mathematical, and the car was old enough, not operated by a computer, I might open the hood and tinker with, who knows, the wires. I wouldn't, but, you know, somebody who is more skillful might. You might decide, I have the physical strength to bike across town. I'll get out my bike and get to the meeting along the bike path, right? So there are different ways that we can solve many everyday problems, right?
Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to critics who assert only one type of intelligence?
I've spent a lot of time doing that. There are a few ways we can look at that, right? So one is, how do you get to the single notion that intelligence is measurable as an IQ score? You sit people down by themselves and, you could do a group administered test. So you sit 30 people, 30 students in a room, five rows of six. You have the whole place quiet. You either sit them these days in front of a screen or in the old days in front of a bubble sheet with a pencil. You give them 60 questions in, I don't know, 90 minutes. And you say, this is how intelligent you are. At the end, you get the result and you're average with 100 IQ, or you're super bright with 145, or you're in trouble with a 70 or whatever. So how good of a sample of human behavior is that test? How many times in the real world do people, you know, when I have the car problem, I don't take out my IQ score and say, I have 145. How do I solve this problem? No, that's not how we operate. So that's, you know, the sampling of human behavior is off, I would say. If you really want to know how people can think and solve problems, you give them more typical situations, like, do they have tools? Can they talk to other people? Can they go online and say, hey, YouTube, can you show me what is wrong with my car and how to fix it? And can they use that information? So the sampling by which we have derived IQ scores is kind of messed up. You don't have a genuine sample of human behavior. That's, I think, a big one. The other one is, a defense of IQ is that it predicts, let's say, job status. If you have 145 or 160 IQ, you're going to go to Google and become a super programmer and get paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, and you'll be just ducky. And if you have a 75 IQ or whatever, 70 IQ, maybe you'll be doing lawn care. Okay, so it kind of is generally predictive of ranking or status of jobs. But when you go within those clusters, you'll see that it doesn't predict who's actually successful in those lines of work. So there's something more to, well, they would argue back, well, gets sort of technical, that the range is restricted. So it's no longer, when you chop up the distributions, it's no longer very, you don't have enough variation to be predictive. But let's set that technical stuff aside. But what it says to people like me is, and to people like Howard, is that within any chunk of occupations, you need a range of different things to be successful. You need to be able to understand how well you work under different circumstances, with whom you might work well, how to use resources and time, like time productively. Can you budget your time? You know, these sorts of things turn out to be incredibly important in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that is measured in an IQ score. And so an IQ can predict maybe what college you'll get into, but not whether you'll be the best student in that college or what kind of occupation you might gain entry to, but not how successful you'll be there. More things are needed. So those are the sort of basic arguments that have been batted around. And I would guess another one would be when you go into a classroom and ask teachers about kids, teachers are not ranking. Teachers will know, okay, this kid is really strong in math and strong in language, but this kid really knows how to work the crowd. This kid knows how to lead a group. This kid knows how to organize a musical and to perform in front of others. So teachers are often much more aware of the range of strengths in the classroom than the IQ score would tell them mm-hmm. or would require them to focus on.
Mm-hmm. So it's very limiting in a way. It's not a lot of data.
Well, the IQ score gives a very limited range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what is the efficacy of the theory of multiple intelligences and how is it assessed?
How is it assessed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there have been a range of different educators who use the theory. And one of the studies that I did entailed extensive interviews in 41 schools. They were quite a diverse set, all public schools, I think only one charter school. They were from all different places in the country, Northeast, Northwest, South, etc. So what these schools report is that the theory is, we can't say causal because there are just so many things going on in a school. You can't say A causes B, but you can say when the theory is being used well in schools, thoughtfully over a period of years, the schools see improvement in student behavior, in parent participation, to a lesser degree in test scores, but they associate it with with some improvement in test scores. And also they find it very helpful for students with learning disabilities, which is not a surprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because disability is often based on, in school, problems in reading or problems in calculation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way that we can assess efficacy, by going into the field, observing, talking with teachers, talking with students themselves, talking with parents. And then over time, there have been other educators all over the world who've implemented the theory thoughtfully. That's the big qualifier, thoughtfully. And report that it really helps students and it also helps teachers. So in another study that I did, I had a hypothesis that MI made no difference. The theory made no difference, which Howard was kind of, that's a typical, what's called a null hypothesis.
Yeah.
Howard was kind of worried about that. When I went into a school this was a master's thesis study. When I went into a school that was divided in half used the theory and half had a more traditionally focused approach, the teachers reported that it helped them to reflect on their practice see what they were doing to reach all different kinds of kids, and then grow their practice once they saw that there was a framework for thinking about their practice in terms of different intelligences and different kids. So that's in the realm of what Howard calls personalization of intelligence, that you have to recognize that there are different kids in your classroom. MI helps you to do that. And when you look at those kids through an MI lens, you grow your practice to meet their needs. So it's a kind of by way of, is it effective? It helps teachers grow their practice. And we have generally cared about that. The whole regime of standardized tests, which came in with George Bush and has been operating for 20 odd years, operates to restrict teachers' ability to deal with all different kids and different using different materials and different kinds of pedagogies, but it's still in effect to some extent.
Yeah. So, well, what does a typical workday look like for you?
Well, because I'm retired, it looks like kindergarten again. I get to play.
Yay.
but what am I doing with my time, I guess, is a reasonable question. And I actually love this question, because when I think about it, I think, well, I have an MI sort of life. I play music every day. I get exercise every day.
Great. You play the flute?
Yep.
Nice.
Yep. Yeah. You know, while I was in grad school and working, I had to set that aside. But retirement plus the pandemic has given me time to play a lot. So I'm playing every day. I'm exercising every day. I'm reading and writing something every day. I'm addicted to reading. That and caffeine are my two major addictions.
So, what are you reading now?
What am I reading now? I just started this new book, which is, I'm listening to it while I'm exercising because it's too long. I think the book is 1,000 pages.
Wow.
It's by an author who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. Her name is Olga something like, or it's a Polish name. I can't pronounce it. Proporsha, something like that. It's called The Book of Jacob. But I just finished another book called Moneyland by Oliver Burrow. And it tells you that money travels across borders, but laws about money don't. That's the basic take home. but it was interesting. So I'm reading I read the Atlantic, the New York Times, the New Yorker, you know, just everything. Random things. I like to read science. I like to read recipes. So all kinds of stuff. So, and then how else? I'm communicating with family and friends. I'm a horrible night owl. So last night was an early night because I was pretty tired. I went to bed at 2 a.m. But at 9 o'clock this morning, my brother called and said, there's a new baby in the family. He's a grandpa again.
Congratulations.
So that's really nice. So that set off a whole range of family phone calls. So there's always conversation in the mix. My husband is quite a conversationalist. So I'm spending my time music, reading, exercise, writing. And you can see that, you know, there's naturalist in the walking outside. There's bodily kinesthetic. There's obviously musical, linguistic. Oh, and I keep the books. So my husband earns the money and I spend it, but I have to keep track of what I spent. So I'm doing the logical, mathematical, and that sort of thing as well.
Cool.
Yeah. And I think if you reflect on your life, Heather, or other people reflect on their lives, they're not just doing math and reading, writing. They're doing a range of things. And to the extent that they're doing them reasonably well, they're drawing meaningfully on and in an in-depth way on these different intelligences that Gardner has laid out for us.
Absolutely. Well, we all have challenges. What are some of your everyday challenges?
Well, I'm spatially challenged. I don't have 3D vision. It's a result of a birth defect which needed to be corrected early in life, I think by the age of 2, but people didn't understand that, so they waited till I was 8. And I've never been able to sync 3D.
Oh my gosh. Really?
So I'm extremely clumsy.
Yeah.
So just, I mean, I'm always, when I was a child, nobody really understood what was wrong, but every single night I spilled my milk. So you'd go to reach for the glass, but where was the glass relative to your hand? You couldn't tell, right, as a little kid. So they just said, had to happen. Every night it had to happen. And yesterday I spilled coffee grounds and hot water everywhere. I spilled oatmeal. You know, like I'm deadly in the kitchen, really, but I like to cook, so I keep at it. Yeah. Well, yeah.
That is a challenge. So
that's a serious challenge. But the beauty is that I've gotten better over time. You learn how to adapt. I no longer reach for doorknobs in midair, right? I slow down and try to calculate these things. And it has turned me into a fantastic driving instructor, because for me to understand spatial relations, I have to turn it into words. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so when the middle of the car is at the corner, you start turning the wheel at that point. So I'm a really good driving instructor. Before that, I was actually a terrible driver.
I can imagine. Well, let's end on a hopeful note. What do you see as hopeful in the world of cognition?
Neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. right? And advances in neuroscience. We're coming to understand so much more about how our brains work and how to protect them. So the importance, for example, of social interaction, really important to brain health. The importance of sleep. Who knew?
Oh, I knew. I learned that in college. Yeah. Super important, people.
Yeah, really, really important. And, you know, the idea of getting stimulation. So not sitting at home watching TV, going out, experiencing friends, going to a museum, taking a little trip to someplace that might be nearby, but you don't visit, going out for a walk in the woods at taking different paths. Mm-hmm. All of these things there's now a science basis for understanding the importance of social interaction, diverse activities, sleep, things that you can do that are relatively straightforward, that it's like, nah, that's just old lady talk. Grandma tells you these things, turn out to be really important for our mental well-being mm-hmm. and to the preservation of our thinking capacities. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually, the science around our brains, neuroscience, has come an enormously long way in the last 20 years. And I think we will have breakthroughs for things like Alzheimer's. This drug that was just released doesn't do a whole lot, but it's a step. We'll have more understanding of how to help people who've had brain injuries. We'll have more global help. If we pay attention to this, we'll have, I think, more globally healthy set of mental capacities preserved for longer periods of time. So I'm actually optimistic about that part of this world.
Awesome. Yeah. This is Community Connections. You have been listening to Dr. Mindy Kornhaber, Associate Professor Emerita at the Pennsylvania State University at the University Park. And I'm Heather Rose with Radio Free Roanoke 95.7 FM.
This is Mindy Kornhaber, Professor Emerita, and you are listening to WROELP Roanoke.